Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Monday, the 22nd of June, 12 minutes past the hour of 9 o'clock. A pleasure to have you all with us on this Monday morning. A hot, sultry weekend. I hope you enjoyed it to the greatest extent. I hope that that heat just baked out the anger in you and left you only with joy, happiness, and empathy. Your results may vary, but maybe that's the case. Let me introduce everybody. We'll get started. A quick reminder, you can join us, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, and we would love to have you join us in on the conversation. Three big topics to talk about today, the three big obvious topics, and we'll address all of them over the next hour and a half or so. WAMC's Alan Chartok is here. Good morning, Alan. How are you?
Hi-yo, Joe.
Good morning. Good morning, good morning. We also welcome Jennifer Burns, UAlbany lecturer in Africana Studies. Good morning, Jennifer. How are you?
I'm great. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning. And political consultant and lobbyist Libby Post is with us. Good morning, Libby.
Good morning.
Now, Libby, we should note, is on the back, coming back from an appointment, and so now is in her car.
I just got home.
Okay.
So I'm going to It'll be much better.
Excellent. So you made your opening, and then when you're at home, everything will be fine. Thank you, Libby. We'll get back to you in just a second as you start to nest there in Albany. Web and Cognitive Sciences at RPI and Director, Professor of Web and Cognitive Studies at RPI and Director of the RPI-IBM Artificial Intelligence Research Collaboration, Jim Hendler. Jim, did I get all that right?
Close enough.
Okay, good.
It's great to be here.
Seems like there's words missing. I'm sorry. Jim Hendler, we love having you here. Thank you very much. It's been a little while, and I appreciate you being here as always. It's a great thrill when you're with us.
Thank you.
Okay. A reminder, quick reminder, keep your letters short and to the point and on topic. Do not send links or attachments. Don't use abbreviations and please proofread your emails before they arrive. We've had a lot of people using text speak, and I know when you write the shorthand for it, to be honest with you, but when you're reading it quickly, I have no idea what that means. So please just don't use abbreviations and make it easy for us. Also, we read letters that are done while we're on the air. So if you've written a letter last night and you woke up, and people do this, they're angry and they wake up and they send off a missive to us, but we don't include them in the show because we want it to be in reaction to what we're talking about. So those are the rules, and all we do is ask you that you follow those and write to us at panel at WAMC.org. Otherwise, we love your letters. All right, let's get started. The big story over the weekend. There were many, but let's go with the one that seems to have the most impact on all of us, and that is the firing of the U.S. attorney in New York who investigated Donald Trump and his inner circle. As you may have heard, on Saturday, President Trump fired the federal prosecutor whose office put his former personal lawyer in prison and is investigating his current one, heightening criticism that the president was carrying out an extraordinary purge to rid his administration of officials whose independence could be a threat to his reelection campaign. Mr. Trump's dismissal of the prosecutor Jeffrey Berman, the United States attorney in Manhattan, whose office has pursued one case after another that have rankled Mr. Trump, led to political blowback and an unexpected result. By the end of the day, Mr. Berman's handpicked deputy, not the administration's favored replacement, was chosen to succeed him for now. The abrupt ouster of Mr. Berman came as Mr. Trump sought to reinvigorate his campaign with its first public rally in months and days after new allegations by his former national security advisor that he had engaged in obstruction of justice as a way of life. We will get to those stories later on regarding the rally and regarding the fallout from the Bolton book. But with our eyes clearly focused on that of Jeffrey Berman, Alan, what do you think?
Well, first of all, who amongst us can forget Trump talking to the Russians and being overheard saying, "I put a stop to this Russian thing by firing Comey." Well, That is his playbook. He fires the people who are doing their jobs. He fires the inspector generals who are coming up with things that ought not to be happening. He fires U.S. attorneys who don't do what he wants. Now, let's remember that this guy interviewed Berman himself. When Piperaro was basically out, Trump interviewed Berman and found him to be entirely satisfactory. But when he started to do his job, he wasn't satisfactory anymore. Do we have to say any more about the long national nightmare that we're in here?
I am curious, though. I want Jim. I'm interested in what you make of the Bill Barr inclusion here, and sort of just the overall weirdness and mishandling of how this was done.
I find it stunning. In fact, here's a quote I'd like to read. With tenacity and savvy, Jeff has done an excellent job leading one of our nation's most significant U.S. attorney's offices. That was a quote about Berman said by Barr on Friday, the day before he fired him. So it's, you know, the craziness of this administration, the lack of communication, the different reports on the Barr stuff that comes out, it's just staggering. And you know, part of it is apparently they wanted to put Clayton, who is the SEC chair who's stepping down, in, despite the fact that Clayton has no has never been a prosecutor. You know, it's just some combination of hubris, audacity, and craziness.
Yeah, let's try to remember, guys, that this president. First of all, he interviewed Berman, and he found him satisfactory. And let's remember that Barr himself did the dirty work, and originally did the dirty work. The president stood up there, and like Alfred E. Newman or Melvin Kosnowski said, "Who, me? I didn't do anything. I didn't even know about this." So then he turns around and says, "Okay, now, since he won't go, and he says the only way he can go is if I fire him, I fire him." So much for not knowing anything about it.
Right.
Yeah, insane.
Libby.
Well, yeah, it's gotten to the point where it's sort of like who's on first and the whole Laurel and Hardy, but Abbott and Costello routine. This administration is unhinged, and clearly, you know, this is just one more example of Trump being ultra Nixonian. I mean, he's taking Richard Nixon and taking it to the hundredth, if not thousandth, power, and it will ultimately be his undoing, because we do have some semblance of a constitutional government here. And the Supreme Court decisions in the last few weeks have shown that they don't want to be known as the Trump court, but they want to be known as their own court or the Roberts court. And if any of this gets challenged and goes up to the Supreme Court, I think that Trump will be in trouble. But, you know, what really comes down to it is he's doing all of this to protect himself for the November election, and it's becoming more and more transparent. And I think it's becoming more and more dangerous for him.
Jennifer Burns.
I agree. Nothing else to add. I agree.
Hey, Jennifer, you and I should just go to lunch. When we can do that.
Seriously.
Well, one of the things I want to just bring out here, which I is obvious, you know, Democrats are very upset about this, demanding probes into the firing of Berman. And Jerry Nadler said this morning that Barr should be impeached, but did acknowledge that trying to get that through the Republican-controlled Senate would be futile. So which brings up the point, Alan, of how much, you know, you can do about it. And the answer is not much.
Well, you know, Nadler, who I have known for a long, long, long time, grew up on the West Side. He was there. I was there. Watched him do his thing. You know, he's full of vim and vigor until it comes down to doing what he needs to do. But he's got a problem, because even the leftist Nadler is being challenged wholesale in a primary this time. And he has got to watch exactly what he says. If he says, well, he doesn't deserve to be impeached, which is, by the way, he shouldn't be impeached, which is, by the way that some newspapers were playing it in the beginning, he could get himself into a lot of trouble because everybody knows he should be impeached. So now the story gets changed around.
Libby? Please.
Like, tomorrow is the primary.
Right.
So unlike when it used to be in September, Jerry would have had to parse his words all the way through the summer. The primary is tomorrow. He's, I would say, 90% probably going to win his primary, and because he hasn't done anything to really make his folks on the Upper West Side angry. Yeah. And then he'll be able to take the gloves off because no Republican is going to win in that district.
Sam, but my problem with that, Libby, is when is the last time you saw Jerry Nadler taking the gloves off? In other words, he was always seen as the fighter's fighter, somebody to the left of center, but he has been a very docile fellow when it comes to all of this. So I don't think he's going to take the gloves off, and I'll tell you why. I think he is, let's see, what's the right word? Lazy.
I beg to differ. I thought he was really very good during the hearings. I thought he was very strong and direct during the hearings.
Well, you saw how effective it turned out to be.
Maybe we were watching. Well, come on, Alan. Let's be real.
Come on.
Everybody complained about Obama not being able to get anything done, and he had two Republican chambers to deal with. You know, they impeached the president in the House, and the Senate let him off scot-free. So, you know, I mean, what else would you expect him to do? He did his job.
I expect him to get out there and fight like hell, because this, if ever there was a situation where this country was in imminent danger of losing its constitutional democracy, this is it. And I wouldn't be sitting still. I'd be yelling. I'd be screaming if I were him. Hey, I've been yelling and screaming, and I'm me.
Okay.
Let us focus for a moment on the replacement. I believe it was Jim who spoke about this a moment ago. Mr. Berman has been in the office since 2018, had declined to leave his post after Bill Barr announced late on Friday night. Then it was announced by Barr that he would be replaced by Jay Clayton, the chairman of the Securities and Exchange Commission, as previously noted. Mr. Clayton is friendly with Mr. Trump and had golfed with the president at his club in Bedminster, New Jersey, as recently as last weekend, according to two people familiar with the matter. But on Saturday, facing a standoff with Mr. Berman, Mr. Barr shifted course. In a letter released by the Justice Department, Mr. Barr told Mr. Berman that Mr. Trump had fired him and that he would be replaced temporarily with the prosecutor's own chief deputy, Audrey Strauss. The choice of Ms. Strauss appeared to mollify Mr. Berman, who then issued a statement saying he would step down in light of the reversal. So how significant is that part of the story, Alan?
Well, before we go there, Joe, just let me say that it really isn't his... the president has the right to fire a U.S. attorney. And I think that that's what has happened here. Obviously, the White House knows that this is a very dangerous situation for them. And it just plays on all the other times he's done exactly the same thing. So I think that there's been this sort of compromise, but it's disgusting.
So what about Strauss?
What about him? I'm sorry.
No, her. The question of the question was about the fact of how Mr. Clayton was supposed to come in, Jay Clayton, the chairman of the Securities and Exchange Commission, and then the way that they worked this all out is to get Berman to back down, is to have Audrey Strauss
and to use the word temporary. Temporary stands out like a great red flag on the beach of Fire Island, you know, meaning don't go in the water. Temporary means she could be replaced at any moment and will be. By the way, if this was such a strong case, I hate to say this, that Berman's been working on forever, I think we would have seen some results by now, but we haven't.
And why do you think that? Yeah, that's a good point. Why do you think that is?
I don't think they had. Look, Giuliani is, in my mind, a very corrupt figure. But I don't know that they had the right case to get him on. And this whole business about his playing around internationally was, I think, if they had it, they would have moved already. Look, Berman moved on his associates much earlier than this. So why not Giuliani? Now, Giuliani, you will all remember, said the president doesn't dare, what's the right word here that can be used on the radio, screw around with me. Because he knows that basically I have information. Meaning,
right.
You know, he moves, I blackmail him.
I know he knows where the bodies are buried.
He sure does.
Nice way to put it. Yeah.
Jim Hendler.
I just, you know, again, I'm just staggered by all of the stuff that's coming out about the different ways this has happened. Clayton on Thursday told his employees he had no, you know, he sent mail to them just saying, looking forward to working with you when we can all get back into the buildings. So, you know, it's like one side doesn't know what the next one's doing. You know, when Barr, so Berman refused to step down. Barr then fired him because he had politicized issues, including his own firing. There's apparently a lot of issues over whether Trump is even able to actually fire Barr because of the way Berman, because of the way Berman was appointed. So, you know, he could have fought in court. It may well be that, you know, there was a story I saw that said that some deal had been reached between Barr and Berman that the cases would be allowed to go on. No one seems to know details of that. So again, it's just one of these things where it's, you know, they do stuff on Friday so it won't hit the news cycle. They try these crazy maneuvers and they get away with it because the Senate is unwilling to stand up to Trump.
Well, and Trump is such a lying liar who knew nothing about this. But as Joe just pointed out, he played golf with his choice. And I have a feeling somewhere between the third and fourth holes, they decided he would take over for Berman.
So let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. When we come back, we'll go to letters, but we also, of course, want to talk about the rally. That happened on Saturday. Still a lot of news being made at that, and we will continue after this short break. You know, it's one of those events on Saturday night that just seemed that everything that could have gone wrong for the president seemed to go wrong. The president, after boasting about enthusiasm and promising a full house, spoke in an arena in Tulsa, Oklahoma on Saturday night with many seats unfilled amid the coronavirus pandemic. We know that the arena, the BOK Center, seats 19,000. We also know that fire officials in Tulsa say that the attendance was 6,200. Most not wearing masks. Hours after his campaign had announced that six members of the advance team staffing the event had tested positive for the virus was when the event was to begin. There was also expected to be an overflow event, which they set up for outside. So all of the people who couldn't get into the BOK Center because of the million of people that were expected to come, they were to go to an alternate site for an outdoor rally. That was canceled as the president was on Air Force One because the problem was there was no overflow. So they canceled that. The speech itself lasted nearly 2 hours. It was filled with grievances, falsehoods, and misleading claims, reading from the Washington Post. Trump said that because more testing means higher numbers of coronavirus cases, his direction was to curtail it. So I said to my people, slow the testing down. A White House official later said the president was obviously kidding. but he has previously expressed skepticism about testing, which public health experts say is required to contain the outbreak. While there's plenty to talk about just in what I mentioned, let me add in these few details. Trump downplayed the severity of the virus, fixating on the number of names used for it and offering one Kung Flu, a racially offensive term. Also, the campaign said quarantine procedures had gone into effect for the infected staff members and those in immediate contact with them. Meanwhile, Tulsa County reported 136 new cases Saturday, marking another high for both single day and average cases, while the state as a whole reported 331 new infections. The president used the excuse of that protesters outside were the ones who that made it impossible for those who wanted to attend to actually attend. But from all accounts, there were only scattered efforts to block entrances, which were quickly resolved by police. And there were no issues. Only six people arrested on charges of obstruction, loitering, and other related offenses. So that is a brief rundown of the rally, which we've been talking about for probably 2 weeks as to having a rally during a global pandemic. And Alan, so this is what you're left with.
So NPR had a story this morning during my long walk. I have to say, I really thought it was terrific. And that is that the Trump people were punked by kids and everybody else who got online and said and asked for tickets, and that's where they came up with their million requests from.
Right.
But in the end, only 6,000 people showed up in the place, and of course CNN had great joy in showing the open stands. During that time. And I began to think, well, is this good that he was punked, or is it speak well of the electorate that they didn't want to show up? Well, the answer is both, right? I mean, he got punked. There's no question about it. On the other hand, we also see that this was that people didn't want to come. And if they wanted to come, they would have had a lot more requests than they had. People would have shown up for the outside rally. End of discussion.
That's right. It was both. And certainly it was an effective tool used by TikTok, but also through TikTok, I should say. But also is you're right. They could have then gone to the other rally, which did not happen. And, you know, you do have to think of, we talked a lot last week, Libby, about the people who were going to show up. And so, you know, if you're concerned about the virus, and obviously many people are, even if you are a Trump supporter, why walk into that?
Well, absolutely. Why walk into that? I mean, you know, people are starting to, he's going to have his 30-35% zealots regardless. I mean, we saw that. I saw pictures of a woman with a newborn. I mean, you know, without a mask on. And it's just insane what some people will do. But I think he's wearing thin on the Republicans who regret their vote. The Lincoln Project is doing an excellent job of reaching out to those folks and sending them the message that this isn't what we signed up for. And the idea that he did a 2-hour speech, who in American politics since, oh, maybe the 1850s or 60s,
since
has
Webster
done a 2-hour speech? You know, right. I mean, this is taking cues from Putin, from Erdogan, from all of these other strongmen who can get up there and speak for hours on end because no one's going to stop them. And clearly no one was going to stop Trump here either, but from everything I've read, because I never watch, because I just can't. I break my television, which is too dear to me. He just rambled on, and it was all grievances, and there was no substance other than his own, you know, dislike and dismay. But the best part of the evening was watching him deplane at the White House from the helicopter. And the walk of dejection that he had for the 10-15 seconds between the helicopter and the front door. It was,
yeah, it was
really
something.
The walk of shame. Yeah, the tie was off.
The walk of shame.
Yeah. You know, the other part of this was you mentioned the length of the speech, 2 hours. But my other favorite part was, you know, favorite being a loose word here, but favorite in that the 20-minute explanation, and I think it was 21 minutes and 5 seconds of the explanation as to his walking down the ramp at West Point, as well as as well as the glass to which he in Tulsa picked up a glass with one hand and drank, in which the crowd went wild, and then people started to write on Twitter going, "Wow, people are really excited that the president can drink a glass of water with one hand." You know, it's just surreal.
You need to get the man a sippy cup.
Jennifer, what did you take from this?
You know, 2 hours is, again, we've covered that this is just crazy, right? But there's so much of this that reminds me of the operations, the language and the behaviors of politicians really during segregation in the 1950s, right? His language of the agitators, right? That's straight out of a segregationist time. The way he's, you know, the radicals, the thugs, tough hombres, right? Kung fu, the kung flu, like the way that he drops these words over and over throughout these 2 hours, I think really fuels the minds of people who are supporting him and don't realize the role of race in his speeches.
Mm-hmm. Well, they do. I mean, I think the argument could be made that, look, these are the heirs to the southern side of the Civil War in many parts, and they do recognize it. That's what they want from him. They want white dominance over black and brown people.
I think some do, but I don't think all do, because some people are willing to, and maybe unconsciously, but they dismiss this language from him. They dismiss it. They, you know, the Washington Post also had an article about, you know, the people who were showing up in support of Trump outside and how they explain to their children, the protesters, you know, and they were saying things to the children that the protesters were the violent factors. You know, the protesters, the ones who are trying to, you know, change history in a way there won't be a legacy for them, and that they don't see, you know, they have the same kind of colorblind rhetoric. So some of them, I think, might in their heart be genuine people, but are not really recognizing. They're kind of caught up and deceived by the impact of this language.
And as you say, isn't it correct to think that the segregationists followed the same playbook of demonizing those people who protested and who demanded their rights and who did all of that, and call them all kinds of names and use hoses on them and police dogs and everything else to back it all up?
Well, that is true. But during segregation, what they were arguing was legal, right? I mean, that was the segregation. There's Jim Crow laws. So when they were doing that, we don't like it now, but that was legal. Today, it is illegal, but it's still happening. And that brings up that kind of structural, systematic way that things are operating that people don't see. They see on paper that things are equal, or it says that, but they don't see how it functions in reality and how it's impacting them. And so I think there's a fine line there for people to see that and understand it. And they have terms mixed up here. They think, you know, that Trump is the leader of the Republican Party, of Lincoln's party. That's just not true. Mm. People are saying that the KKK, you know, came out of the Democratic Party. Yes, but not the same, because the parties flipped later, right? So not having an understanding of that then perpetuates more language that continues to racialize things and is inaccurate.
Although we did see Woodrow Wilson get his this weekend. He was a fierce segregationist, a terrible man. You know, from a personal point of view, but I don't know. I mean, I think that the argument could well be made. Look, you're the expert, Jennifer, not me. But the argument could be made that while it may have been legal back in the day, you know, the things that they were protesting, it was also wrong.
That is true. It is true that it was wrong. But we do a lot of hindsight looking and say people then should know. But yeah, we can't hold them to exactly what's happening in real time that they're living, right? I mean, this is the law. People are enforcing it. It took the civil rights movement to begin to address, didn't fully fix. But you saw, I mean, you go back and watch the tapes and the videos, the information from the time, you know, they're saying segregation now, segregation forever. This is the way it goes. The Bible supports it, all these things. And the law supported it. And so it's not that we can't say, okay, they were obviously operating as racist, because they were. However, in that time period, right, when this is really the law of the land, either very frontally colored and white or systematically outside the South, it takes people to live a little bit of a different experience for them to be able to look back as largely as we do today and say how wrong that was.
Well, you certainly are right. You certainly are right that it's a different time and it's a different set of circumstances. But to me, the motivations are identical. The people who are in the so-called bad guys are the ones who basically want dominance over black people and brown people. I don't know. I mean, I don't think it's changed.
I do want to ask Jennifer about the other part. Is we've been talking a lot about the length of the speech, but in two hours, nothing was really talked about race, about the dialogue that this nation is having over policing, over race, over racial politics, and none of that was brought to the forefront.
Because he doesn't address things really head on in that kind of way. So, right, so he'll throw something out there like, you know, I think he did say something about Joe Biden, right? Like, if people want racial justice, it would begin with Joe Biden's retirement or something like that, right? So I think, and I'm like, oh, okay. You know, so it's these subtle kind of things where people chomp onto them. But by using this language that stirs in the mind really terrible stereotypes and oppressive, dangerous ideas about people from color, of color, without saying it directly, it still fuels the unconscious thinking of many people who will say that they don't see race, which we know is, you know, really a racist comment, but also people who say, well, wait, I have people in my family who are black and brown, and they're just fine, you know? And so he really plays on this language without going directly at it in a way where people's minds miss it. It's like watching things on TV, those subtle influences, right, in language and vision that change how you think if you don't correct it.
Before we go to a break, and we're late for the break, but Jim Henwer, I want your thoughts before we go over.
Yeah, I was going to move towards the social media side, and maybe we can return to that after the break if you want, Joe, but you know, we're all looking at how Trump got punked on this by the teens and TikTok and K-pop folks. But, you know, there's an interesting underpinning here of how Trump used social media in the past, is trying to use it again while manipulating the companies to stop making it fair. And now other people are starting to learn how to use it back, both on purpose and by accident. So it's going to be very interesting to see how that plays out across.
Fascinating.
We'll take a break. When we come back, we will continue. Alan Chartok, Jennifer Burns, Libby Post, and Jim Henwer, you're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC. We have a top of the hour break and a couple of letters, so I want to get to those before we go, and we'll try to tidy up some of the letters that we have here. Tom says, I guess what concerns me is what appears to us to be outrageous is business as usual for about half the country and for most of the Senate. How is this playing out in the conservative media? This is the Berman, Barr, Trump troika. How are they justifying this obstruction of justice, the wholesale Trumpification of the court system, inspectors general, federal agencies, etc., draining the swamp, eliminating the deep state, And then we got this letter from Brenda, who said, what happened on Friday between Barr's complimenting Berman and when he fired him? Let's hear the reason. And as Jim, as you indicated, there is no reason.
No, I think there was
a
reason.
Yeah, there's not much of a reason, although I do like Rudy Giuliani on Saturday said Trump may have fired U.S. Attorney General over bull, et cetera, investigations. And that's the Fox News headline this morning.
Yeah.
I mean, I think the reason it was coming. Joe, I suspect they just got ahead of themselves. They knew they were firing him. So you know, usually when you kick a guy out the door, you say something nice about him. I think they said there's something nice about him, but they knew that this was the time to say something nice because they were firing him.
Russ says if Trump could get away with what Putin does, would Berman have simply disappeared, never to be heard of again?
Yes.
Suzanne says, let's see, we go to, with things going sideways for Trump, can you see him claim that he's gotten tired of being president and resigned before the Republican convention so another candidate can be chosen? No, right?
No.
Absolutely not.
I think we all agree on that. No.
Although
I did hear another interesting conspiracy theory over the weekend about the inclusion of Elise Stefanik, that this was a trial run for her, that with Trump not doing well with white women and also just not doing well, that the campaign needed a spark. The way the theory went was that you would blame Pence for the poor handling of the coronavirus, and then you would say that's why you fire him, and then you bring in Elise Stefanik, who is a young woman who would be able to give some energy to the campaign. That is a theory being floated. Would the panel like to comment on that theory? Elise Stefanik, of course, a congresswoman from our region.
Please go ahead.
Okay, they both, Elise Stefanik and Ted Jacob, her Democratic opponent, both raised a tremendous amount of money this weekend on that rumor and on just the fact that Elise was there and backing up the president. My question is this. If he dumps Pence, what does that do to the evangelical vote? Because that's what Pence brought to the table. And is keeping at the table. And I just wonder whether or not it's based on Pence or if they've really fallen and are truly enamored with Trump. And I think that some of them are, but it'll be very interesting to see what that impact would be.
I don't think Pence brings, what's the Yiddish word for this, for nothing? Is it bupkis to the entire?
Bupkis. Yes.
Yeah, to the entire, I don't know what the literal translation is. That's why I hesitated.
But we don't have to worry, you know.
But, we'll hear it in the letters.
We certainly will. Forget it. We know what it is.
I don't think
Pence brings anything. These people, these Trump voters, it's all a matter of race. I've said it all along. They want to be the dominant race. It really is not the evangelical part of it. It is the racial part of it that it makes disgusting.
But the thing is that the racial issue is part of the evangelical Christian right. This is one of the things that they have yet to reckon with within their own religious beliefs. And so, you know, they are interwoven together.
Well, as you know, from panel members of ours and other places, there are people who are evangelicals who are anything but racist. I think that lumping everybody into the same group is a little bit dangerous, although, you know, maybe not.
Well, if you think some of the evangelicals right now, as Libby said, you know, there has been a racial component to the evangelical movement. Yeah. You know, but I do think we've seen a lot of coverage in the last few weeks during the protests. But many evangelicals who are coming out to say, whoa, you know, they were questioning some of their tenets and some of the systematic racism that they maybe just weren't aware of before versus those who are like, oh, no, you know, we're still fine with it. So there's a little shift happening in some of, you know, to Alan's point, in some of the evangelical community for sure.
So,
as you know, elections are won or lost by 1 or 2 or 3%, and 5% in most elections is considered a blowout. So when you say, Jennifer, I think you're right that there's a little bit of wiggle room here. That could spell one more disaster for Trump.
So the flip side to this, of course, is the Elise Stefanik role and that part of the rumor. But what would she bring to the table that would be positive?
Young, female, and as suggested on the panel already, the loss of white women would be, they think, some people might think, would be stopped. I don't think he can get rid of Pence. I think if he gets rid of Pence, they'll be held to pay.
Jim?
Right. I do, too.
Yeah, I think he's stuck with Pence. It would need a really good excuse to throw him under the bus. I'm not sure COVID would do it, because then he would have to believe in, you know, admit COVID's happening. So it's an interesting thing. I do think, you know, the other question is, would Stefanik play well with his base as opposed to extending it, because he can't afford to lose that crowd? So it'd be an interesting political decision.
What do you mean?
Be fun.
What do you mean?
Well,
in other words,
I mean, she's conservative, but, you know, this is not a group that tends to rally behind female candidates and younger candidates in general. So, you know, I don't know if she would be seen as a big positive among a lot of his base.
Well, if she says the right things, she would be. She would have to say really disgusting things, but she has proven to us she's capable of carrying his water for him.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
All right, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. We have Alan Chartok, Jennifer Burns, Libby Post, and Jim Hendler. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org. We'll be right back. We did get a lot of letters in regards to our conversation about Elise Stefanik and the possibility of her perhaps taking over Mike Pence in the race for vice president. Many people who have written to us have pointed out that if that is the case, that he would need to learn to pronounce her name, as he kept on referring to her throughout the evening as Stefanik. So we got that, and thank you. It's a good point for what it's worth. A good point. Here's some letters, and then we'll move on to other topics. Karen says, regarding Elise as a replacement for Pence, I do not see the base objecting to a young female running mate as they embrace Sarah Palin when McCain picked her. Did not win the election, however. Michael says, I was born and raised in Tulsa, though I haven't lived there in more than 40 years. Knowing Tulsa, I fully expected an overflow crowd for Trump's visit and was morbidly pleased to learn that basically nobody showed up. But let's not get cocky. It's true that Tulsa is the most liberal city in Oklahoma, with the exception of Norman, home of the University of Oklahoma. But that's kind of like saying that Goring was the nicest of Hitler's henchmen. Mark,
that's terrible.
Yes. Mark said, it was again bringing us about Elise Stefanik's name being mispronounced, but said, did she even speak? Did anyone other than Trump speak? I hope the taxpayers did not pay for the trip. I think this was on the campaign's account. Jim, this one's for you. Bob says, nothing succeeds like success. I predicted the powerful impact that the teens and 20-somethings had on Trump's campaign attendance expectations, and its embarrassment when those expectations collided with reality will stimulate them to make many more such actions in the future. Woke young people, many not old enough to vote, are now leaning into this race in a powerful way that bodes ill for Trump's reelection chances. Your thoughts on that? And my follow-up to that, Jim, would be, what is the way for the Trump campaign to counter that now that they are aware of it?
So I suspect what the Trump campaign is going to have to do to counter it is A, being much more careful, making people put in certain kinds of information, maybe even moving to charging, which of course will hurt their base, but it can be a small charge. I think the bigger issue of how this is going to play out is very interesting, especially as, well, some of these are pre-voting, some of them are voting members. And I think, you know, I say it almost every time I'm on the show, if we can get the younger folks out to vote, it will make a huge difference. The Republicans are aware of that. In fact, they're trying now to create new rules in most of the swing states, trying to make it much harder for college students to vote, and especially as the college students now will be distributed around the country in many cases during November. So, you know, it's a very interesting thing watching this all play out. By the way,
Jim, isn't the next rally that he's got scheduled put on by a youth group who've invited him rather than being his rally, as I read it?
I'm sorry, I don't know.
I think I am right that this new rally, Joe, could you check this, that the new rally, the next place he's going, is in fact an invitation by a younger group for him to come. Sorry about that.
It's certainly the case that it's certainly the case that, you know, the youth is not monolithic. I mean, you know, as is anyone.
We all know
that every college has college Republicans and things like that. So hard to know.
Sure, but I do think that they're worried about the youth vote. I also think it's one of the reasons that AOC and the others are doing so well is because they, to the left of the party, are appealing to the most motivated of those young people.
Yep. He is expected to attend a... Take the reading, and this is from the Wall Street Journal. He is scheduled to attend a Students for Trump gathering in Phoenix on Tuesday, in addition to a border security event in Yuma, also in Arizona. And then on Thursday, he had planned, and then I don't know whether that means that he is no longer, but he had planned to travel to Wisconsin, another battleground state, for a speech at a shipyard.
No, I think it's the Arizona one I was referring to.
Yeah. But I don't know, but that's not... So I don't know if that different than a rally, though, right? I don't know. Meaning
that's two of us.
Yeah, I don't know, like if it's a presidential event, or a rally that we see, and that I don't know. And these seem to be somewhat up in the air too, so I don't know where they're headed. Which would indicate, right, Alan, that there's probably a lot of head scratching going on right now, figuring out what the next step to do. You know, how much do you go to a smaller venue? Do you to keep it full? What do you do?
Well, I do think that they probably thought that this was his reopening of his campaign. I know it because he said so. That this was the way that they were going to move forward and reverse their problems. It turns out that it's exactly the opposite. This really kills that idea, what they do in order to stay ahead of it. And by the way, I think the Arizona event was generally billed as the next one. So they can say whatever they want about it, but I think they've got a problem here.
So I found some information on the Arizona one. Apparently it's a mega church in Phoenix, seats only 3,000 people. It was created by Students for Trump. The group says they had not actually confirmed with Trump at the time they booked it. The church is actually denying that they knew Trump was coming, and that the apparently there's some back and forth about it.
Lying contagious?
Seems like
contagious. Is lying a contagious disease?
I'm sure lying is a contagious disease, is one of those Democratic conspiracies, but we're not going to test for it anyway, because then we would discover it.
Very, very nicely done. Let us talk about that, shall we? Go ahead, Libby.
Well, I was just going to say, if this rally is going to take place and it only holds 3,000 people, it's the old adage of lots of people in a small space is better than a small amount of people in a big space. So it's all about the optics. So they can make 3,000 people in a smaller space look like a big crowd, which is exactly what they'll do.
If this not only that, Libby, but it'll be not only that, but it'll be their people. So it would be much harder to be punked the way they were the last time.
Yeah, because they're, if it's all by invitation, then it's not open to the general public.
Right.
So President Trump's Saturday night remark, this is what Jim was alluding to a moment ago, that he asked officials to, quote, slow the coronavirus testing down, sparked harsh rebukes from experts and frustration from his own staffers, who say it undercuts their efforts to reassure Americans as the disease surges around the country. The president's comment, which came on the same day that eight states reported their highest ever single-day case counts, drew a chorus of criticism from congressional Democrats and public health officials who worry that the president is more concerned with saving face than combating the pandemic. The Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security said looking at it as a scoreboard is the wrong way to think about it. To think of it as something you can manipulate or slow down based on what the numbers look like speaks to a complete misunderstanding of what an infectious disease response should be. You know, obviously, if you stop testing, you will not know that as many people have it. And yes, the numbers will go down, but it does not mean that people will not have the virus. And the president told his supporters on Saturday night, here's the bad part. When you do testing to that extent, you're going to find more people. You're going to find more cases. So I said to my people, slow the testing down, please. As those words were tumbling out of the president's mouth, we should note that the White House was issuing statements to the press saying that that was a joke, that it was tongue-in-cheek.
You know, you know, my mother taught me there are some things you don't joke about.
Yeah, there's nothing funnier than a good pandemic joke, is there?
Right, right. Ba-dum-bum.
Well, by the end of this week, we'll hit 125,000 Americans dead. So it's something to laugh about.
Yeah, it's and so, but meanwhile, we do.
Meanwhile, I saw it five times, Joe. Saw the president's remark, and if he was kidding, boy, there wasn't the slightest hint about it. Not around the corners of his mouth, not on his eyes. He meant it. There was no question. He meant it. This is the same guy who said there would only. This was the same guy who said there would only be 15 cases in the whole United States, that it was a Democratic hoax, that the whole thing was made up. So, you know, a lying, lying, lying liar is a lying, lying, lying liar. That's all there is to it.
The thing about the statement, of course, is that he has made it before. He made it last week. He made it the week before that. So it is in concert with that. Also, and to Jim's point, people are still getting sick, and they're getting sick in record numbers around this country. And even someone from the president's from the administration commented yesterday that the administration was preparing for a fall wave in the autumn. But a lot of health officials saying, OK, that may very well be the case, but let us not forget that we're not out of the first wave. And that this is taking us to very dangerous places. And then there was an article in the New York Times on Sunday about who's being impacted by this. And this goes back to a very early story during the pandemic, that the people, especially those who are now being impacted because of the reopenings or just some of the original failures to quarantine and to social distance, are leading a number of the cases to impact 20, 30-year-olds, very young people who are getting sick and are also getting very sick for a very long period of time, which is different than the narrative that has also been going with, unfortunately, has been going with this disease, that it is impacting primarily the elderly who were, quote, on their way out anyway. Libby?
You know, it's just...
Did I make you speechless?
Yes. I mean, you know, this man has absolutely no regard for anyone but himself and his own power and what he wants. You know, this shows, his presidency shows, you cannot run government like a business. You know, Donald Trump became really famous with The Apprentice and his signature line of "You're fired," right? Now he thinks he has always thought that he can do that with impunity throughout government. We keep seeing it. He fires inspector generals. He fires Jeff Berman. He fires, you know, people that he doesn't like or doesn't, you know, agree with him or is a threat to his agenda. And it's just mind-boggling that there are so many people in this country, albeit 30 to 35% of the population, who are standing with him and are saying, yep, that's the way to go. They should be fired. They don't agree with the president. You know, these are people who are, his direct quote, "I love the less educated." So these are people who are lower educated, less educated. Racism is their way of life. And they see him as a savior. It's just astounding. But really, I'll go back to what my mother taught me. There are things you don't joke about. People dying, people getting sick is not something you joke about. He has no empathy.
Mm.
Jennifer? Well, I would say, you know, this to me is another example of just his operation behaviorally, right? And it brings up the Bolton book, right? What we hear from all these people mm-hmm. who are coming out and writing books about Trump's presidency in the White House is that he really doesn't have any kind of consequential thinking. Right. Like he can't be mm-hmm. he doesn't read a lot of the things people give him is what many of these reports say, that he kind of says whatever he wants. And then tomorrow he'll say something different. So it's really just a behavioral way he's always operated, you know, kind of like that art of the deal sort of way he goes. So this to me is just another example of that mode of operation that he kind of exhibits in all aspects of his life.
Again, the data guy talks, but it's really interesting to look at some of these numbers about what's happening with the, you know, the ages and also what the different patterns of what's happening to people. So people in their 30s and 40s are now catching the disease at a much higher rate than before. One obvious question is that because of the disease or is that just because they're not taking as much care of themselves? When you look at the big pictures of people on the beach, they're much younger. They're not in their 60s. But the symptoms that we're seeing in the deaths among those people are quite different. It's a smaller rate, but it's a scary thing going on. And there's a lot of people working to see, are we seeing new mutations of the disease? Is this just something about the disease we wouldn't know about? Is this new kind of comorbidity? So starting in April, there were reports of strokes that are usually seen in the elderly hitting people in their 30s and 40s. And it was, in every case, they were COVID positive. So again, it's a scary disease. And this notion that we can just ignore it is definitely a mistake.
Deborah writes to us and says, if kids can punk a rally like Trump's, what does it say about the ability of professional hackers and state actors to impact our elections? Jim, is that a fair comparison?
Yep. So
I was really hoping you would say no, but okay.
But he's exactly
well,
right.
I mean, so, you know, I mean, part of it is raising awareness. So, you know, I usually use the example of TV commercials, right? There was a period where TV commercials were much more effective for two reasons. One is because we all had to sit through them, which with streaming is less so. But the other thing is we sort of had to be taught, trained, and understand that people were tricking us. I think social media advertising, people haven't mm-hmm. come to that mm-hmm. realization yet, but they're starting to. I think a lot of the news about what was happening, you know, we're trying to do things to break information bubbles and things like that. That's not going very well. People listen to who they listen to. But at least the ability of professional hackers to do some of these things is getting harder. As there are new ways to detect some of that. But you know, it depends on the social media companies deciding that they care more about some of this stuff than they do about making money. And that in this country is very hard to argue.
When, let's see, we have another, I just want to get, we have a few moments here. Paul says, why do folks, and I particularly have in mind folks who put together many of Governor Cuomo's major legislative programs, such as the so-called SAFE Act, think it is unnecessary to ascertain the relevant facts and law before advancing proposals? As relevant here, the Constitution prohibits electors from voting for a president and vice president from the same state, at the least guaranteeing litigation concerning whether Trump has effectively transferred his legal residence to Florida.
How do you figure that? In other words, oh, I see. If Stefanik were the
correct
candidate, then
yeah,
it
would be true from the same state, unless you can prove that Trump, which I believe he has, right? He has moved his residence to.
Well, there is
Florida.
there is some problems with this because. There are those people who have raised the fact that he has claimed Florida as his new residence, but also voted from the White House.
Right.
So there is some dispute over where he really lives.
Interesting to see where he pays taxes.
Great? Yeah. Well, he doesn't. But wouldn't it be great if he couldn't vote?
And while you're on the subject, Libby, there have been there's a theory, I think I read it in the Times, that the court is ready to rule on his taxes finally, and that it might be this week, and we might find out a hell of a lot, especially if Roberts goes along with everything else he's been doing.
Right, and that coupled with his Trump's niece's book that Trump is saying she can't publish because of an NDA on a family matter. But I think it's going to come out anyway, just like Bolton's book came out anyway. So it'll be interesting. But wouldn't it be great if he couldn't vote?
Well, no.
I think that would be great.
Everyone should be able to vote, right?
Not if you're cheating. What's that? Is that the train coming?
No, that's my house phone. Everybody should be able to vote, except in, I think it's either Kansas or Kentucky, where there are over 600,000 people of color, black and brown people, in one area, and there is one voting place for them, one polling place.
Oh, terrible. It's terrible.
So sure, everybody should be able to vote, except for the shenanigans and those voter suppression that the Republicans are foisting upon the public.
Good point, but I want to know, when that person called you just now on the other phone, were they going to say to you,
the house phone.
Did you know, Libby, that you're on the radio right now?
No. No, my name is not in the phone book or
there
whatever
you go.
It is.
All right.
My name's not on those bills.
A bad attempt at humor.
Suzanne says Trump has no idea what a joke is. He's never showed the slightest sense of humor. He only says that when he said something so outrageous that he has to excuse it somehow. I would point out that it wasn't he who said that. It was everyone else left at the
right.
White House that was trying to clean up the mess. Bob said...
No, but he has claimed sarcasm in an awful lot of cases, including drinking bleach and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Man, Bob says post-Nazi era Germany had to utterly reject their own history of bigotry, racism, and murder to prevent it from happening again, and continue to try to do so to this day. We have reached a tipping point that most Americans of good conscience in this country now desire to do the same as regards to our black brothers and sisters. We want to reject all segregation and racist symbols. There will be resistance from the racists and bigots and entrenched entitled. Jennifer.
Well, I mean, it's true. We just saw, too, with the banning by NASCAR.
Yes.
Right. And then the private plane flies over with the Confederate flag. People set up stations outside to sell Confederate memorabilia, and they said their sales have all gone up. I think it was last week, too, where Trump said somewhere that the Confederate flag is a religious symbol, which goes back to the point we were making earlier about some of the evangelicists and how, you know, racism has been in the church. It's got these dual symbols for people. So, you know, there's going to be pushback. And
Well, we in the most, in, I'm sorry to interrupt, but the most troubling of the incidents in regarding NASCAR was the driver who really led the charge in this.
The black driver.
Bubba Wallace found a noose in his garage last night at Talladega. That is very concerning.
He didn't find it. Somebody else found it. But yes, that's true.
Yeah. And then, of course, there's the Blue Lives Matter car, right? There's all this new symbolism coming up to challenge it all, to still make your statement. And like the writer said, it is expected. And I think, you know, one of the things that we need to do is really look at the deep meanings and trying to go beyond just conversations about what it means, but also the truth about what these symbols are connected to and what, you know, pushing them forward and continuing to perpetuate them in these
We do have
ways.
To take a break. So I'm going to pause you there. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Very nice to have you with us for our last call. About 15 minutes left in the segment, and we welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. Last night on television was the big John Bolton interview on ABC with Martha Raddatz. In that interview, with all of the stuff back and forth of the book and the court ruling that the book could go ahead as planned on Saturday, the interview, I would just like to point out, the book isn't even out yet, but it will be out tomorrow. And
Well, it isn't, but it is. I mean, by now everything's been sort of leaked.
But people can't go out and get it yet. And President Trump poses a danger for the Republic, according to John Bolton, and would be an even greater threat if he wins a second term this fall because he would be unconstrained by future electoral considerations. This, of course, one of the most scathing public assessments of a sitting president by such a high-ranking former aide in modern times. Mr. Bolton depicted Mr. Trump as an erratic and impulsive leader who cares only about his own needs, does not fully understand democracy or the Constitution, is played like a fiddle by Russia, and is not, quote-unquote, fit for office. You know, we've obviously talked a lot about this, and the big question being, well, where was John Bolton when the impeachment hearing was going on? And where were these statements? Alan, I guess I asked not to relitigate that point, but to ask, so how should we take this now and look forward and with this information from somebody who was so high ranking in the administration?
Well, let's put it this way. Bolton is hardly a hero. You know, he's self-serving. The reason he didn't show up clearly at the at least that's what I make of it at the impeachment hearings is because he didn't want to sacrifice his earnings from his book. And everybody said it at the time, and I think it's probably true. Nevertheless, even though he is a conservative, even though he is not a man that I admire very much, I got to tell you, I think what he's doing now is doing incredible harm to this president. And therefore, I think, you know, from that perspective, I'll give him his due. He's articulate. He's making the points, and he's bringing us information, which is very, very scary.
Libby?
Oh, I think that I think what Bolton is doing is giving cover to those Republicans who are like, what are we going to do? I can't stand this anymore. And now have the ability, because they couldn't think for themselves, to say, yep, nope, not going to vote for Trump. I might stay home. I might not be able to vote for Biden, but I'm definitely not going to vote for Trump. And that will help Biden get elected in the fall as well. I too think that, you know, he waited for his money, you know, in true fashion, someone of his ilk. And I'm surprised it was only $2 million, to be quite honest with you.
They're talking about $6 million now. They're talking about $6
million. Oh, $6 million.
And in fact, the judge who ruled, I think, referenced $6 million bucks. I may be wrong about that.
Well, and he also referenced that he could possibly lose it. I'm not sure how that would work. But nonetheless, I mean, I think Bolton, this could very well be a fatal blow to Trump, because Bolton is well-respected in the Republican Party, in the conservative foreign policy folks. You know, he's a warmonger. There's no two ways about it. And I don't think any of us really agree with what he has to say, except his evaluation of Trump.
Jennifer.
That's it. I think what's so frightening is that because there are so many other distractions going on, like local elections and protests and then the rally and the pandemic, that many Americans are, or some Americans at least, are losing sight of this bigger international picture and America's reputation. You know, we're seeing the protests, the Black Lives Matter protests that are happening overseas directed at American systematic issues. But I don't think people are really paying attention to the, you know, the idea of what Bolton said is that Trump doesn't, you know, he's not operating by philosophy, strategy, or policy. There's no strategic plan there. And that is something people really need to pay attention to. So I think he's bringing a revival to trying to create this complicated interworking for people to really pay attention to, that it's not just a local, you know, next election thing. It also has to do with all these global components we really need to know about.
You bring up the election, and that is, we have a couple of letters of people asking for the panel to comment on this. We have talked about it in the past, but it is tomorrow, so I'm interested in what you all make of the Elliott Engel race as this longtime Congress from New York tries to avoid an AOC-style upset. Alan.
He could lose. There are polls that say he is going to lose. It's possible. I've interviewed him on the Congressional Corner, of course, and he's a very bright guy. You know, there is a mood in the land to reject us older people and to say, well, you know, we know better and we're younger and we can do this better. And we ought to send a shot across their bow, and he could lose.
So the question, Libby, is how did Jamal Bowman, a former middle school principal who has never run for office, become so competitive in this race?
Because Elliott Engel was heard on a live mic saying something like, if it wasn't for COVID, I wouldn't care. And that has galvanized people. He also had the backing of, you know, AOC and that whole part of the party, and that whole structure that they've got going. And so they were able to bring in a lot of money. And we have to remember, this district, while it is mostly Westchester, it's southern Westchester. That's Mount Vernon, Yonkers. I mean, this is I don't know if it's fully minority-majority district, but there's a lot of people of color who are there and who vote. Right.
Yeah.
Right. And he's been there for a very, very long time, just like Joe Crowley was. And he was found hidden in his house in D.C. and not in the district during the pandemic. And so all of this together could really, you know, do him in. And, you know, there's times when it's time for people to retire. He's been there for 30 years. He's the longest tenured member of the state delegation. And that district, you know, may very well deserve to have somebody who looks like that district representing them in Congress.
Does it, given that Engel is so high profile and is so senior in the Congress, does that play into the decision, you think, of voters, or should it, Alan?
I don't know. You know, he is, of course, around for a long time, and he has acquired incredible amounts of power as the chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee.
The fourth-ranked House Democrat.
Yeah. Crowley was, too. Crowley was going to be the speaker.
Yeah.
And I don't think people give it. I don't people give. Wait, is that the train coming through? I don't think people care.
Yeah, the train's coming.
Either that or there's a cat outside. So anyway, I think, but I truly think you know, there comes a point. There does come a point. And that while, for example, let me give you an example. Richie Neal, who is my congressman from the 1st District of Massachusetts, who is one of the brightest, most articulate, wonderful men I've ever met in my life. But he's been there a long time, and he's the chair of the of the incredible, you know, committee that handles money in the Congress. Well, come on now. If we lose Richie Neal, we will have lost a great deal in our district, in the 1st District. So, you know, you can't just say because somebody's been around a long time, what have they done when they're around, and then how good are they? That's right. What I'm thinking.
Right. And Engel has delivered for his district. Millions of dollars. And so, well, you know, it will remain to be seen. The whole thing about being the chair of the Foreign Relations Committee, you know, that's a higher level of recognition of thinking about a politics. And when you don't have food on your table, you don't really care about that. You want somebody who's going to make sure that you can feed your kids. And so, you know,
well, that's a very good point.
It's not going to be easy for him.
That's a very good point.
It's not going to be easy for him.
That's a very good point, because most of the people who don't, you know, who are saying, well, he's brought all this money into the district, they say, you know, it's like when your mother said, eat your food, think of all the starving kids in Europe, and you look up at her and you say,
right,
name one. name one. Say, well, he may have brought any money into the district, but, and do I have any of it?
Does a Republican have a shot of winning that race?
No.
In the fall? No.
So
no.
Yeah. So no. So it'll be set by tomorrow.
Yes. Yeah. It's just like the primaries locally here in the city of Albany, Albany County, even going into Schenectady. You know, if you win a Democratic primary, you win. Period. And we have a primary here tomorrow. So you know, and there are primaries from the left here tomorrow, and so it'll be an interesting thing to see how it all plays out.
All right, we are out of time. My thanks to everybody for being a part of the program this morning. Alan Chartok, thank you so much.
Welcome.
Jennifer Burns, Libby Post, and Jim Hendler, thank you, and we will continue after this.